Quite a segue.
That's right. Tricky.
You gonna do it?
No.
No.
You're here. Just in time delivery.
So I'd like to welcome everybody belatedly, I mean myself belatedly, and our first... We rang the bell, eh?
I did.
Good. Our first speaker there is Jeff Whittle, and he's going to tell us about Grass and Metroids 3.
It's a very disappointing list, really. From my point of view, anyhow. Right. This is a Graphs and Matroids 3, but we'll go straight into Matroids now. And the first thing is to why giving a talk to people who aren't Matroid theorists and why you might be interested in Matroids. And I think that, on reflection, I think probably the main reason why people in this audience might be interested in Matroids is that the problem that you've got may not be matroidal. You might have a graph problem, but in exactly the same reason as the problem that you've got, you're looking for solutions in the reals, and in the same way that Alan was talking about the other day. In fact, often going to the complex plane, you get clearer vision. And it's often that many graph problems really do have their natural level of generality at matroids. And if you see them matroidally, in fact, you see the wood for the trees, you actually find a clearer setting in which to prove the theorem. It's not always the case, but that's if you're not interested in matroid theory as a primary focus, that's probably the value of matroids for you. And so there's a sort of a vaguely philosophical thing that I want to begin with, because it surprises me that matroids are not a much, much, much more developed subject. Because if you think about the history of mathematics, and to some extent, a lot of mathematics has really been to understand the mathematics of the world around us. And what do I mean by that? Really, essentially, what's this mathematical structure of Rn in some sense? And when we look at that, there are sort of three aspects. We can think about the algebraic aspect, and that leads to the real number line, and then we abstract from that, and eventually we get, you know, a deep and rich theory. Algebra, group theory, really, when you sort of perpetuate that line when we're thinking about the algebraic structure of space around us, or the algebra that we need, then that leads to group theory, and that's terrific. That's a very highly developed branch of mathematics. If we think about the analytic structure of the space around us, then that leads to analysis and topology, an extraordinarily highly developed branch of mathematics. Well, what's the other part of the structure of space around us that we can think about? It's the combinatorial structure. And if we think about the combinatorial structure, that leads to matroids. And so what's combinatorial about Rn? And what's combinatorial is when you have a set of vectors, and by the way, for the purpose of this talk, all sets are going to be finite. Being finite is much more combinatorial than being infinite, right? So when you have a set of vectors, that set of vectors is either independent or not. And that's a combinatorial factor, linearly independent, right? When I say independent, that's a combinatorial factor about a set of vectors. So if we want to understand the combinatorial structure of the space around us, then we should understand the combinatorics of independent sets of vectors. And it really is a big surprise to me that in a formal sense this wasn't really thought, no one thought of doing this in any serious way. Of course, like all things, you can go back forever into history and see, you know, I mean, you can go back to Euclid and see purely sort of combinatorial type theorems that don't involve any metrical properties and things like that. But in fact, in terms of a sort of a formal study of the combinatorial structure of the space around us, you really have to go back to Whitney in the 1930s, and there's a somewhat more complicated history, I won't go through the full detail. And you have to say, well, okay, if I want to understand the combinatorial structure of the space around us, what I've got to say is, what are the properties of finite, of independent sets? And you sit there and think about it, and you can come up with So you're axiomatizing, you're looking for an axiom scheme that somehow characterizes these things in the same way that you're looking for the axioms of a field or something like that. And of course, you can get some obvious properties. Any subset of an independent set is independent. The empty set is independent. But then that really doesn't capture much. So what really captures independent sets in a vector space, and it's what really captures it, is that you can augment any independent set to a basis. That's something that you teach in any elementary course in linear algebra, right? And of course, that means that there's a very well-defined invariant of a vector space, which is called the dimension. It's because there's a very well-defined invariant of a vector space called the dimension that linear algebra is so smooth. And anyone who studied modules over rings knows that all turns to custard in that. So that's an extraordinarily important fact. And so that well-defined invariant, what does that mean? Well, if we think of it more just in an axiom thing, it says, if I give you an independent set, and I give you an independent set, another independent set, and this one's bigger, it's got more elements, then there's always something that I can add, take from the bigger one to add to the smaller one, and such that I'm still independent. I can grow the smaller one from a bigger one. That's really essentially what you've got. And there you go, I've just given you the axioms of a matroid. It's just what you would come up with. There's nothing special about it. So formally, what do we say? Matroid is just something with a ground set, some arbitrary set of elements. So we're just abstracting that, so we're just thinking of the properties. You all should all think about the properties of a finite set of vectors in some vector space as your model for this. But now we're abstracting from that and forgetting about that it doesn't have to come from a vector space. And so we have those three properties there. And then we'll say, if I've got a collection of subsets of a set, they're the ones I'll call independent, and they satisfy those, and I look at that collection of subsets, and they satisfy those properties, then I'll call that object a matroid.
What's that letter?
Hmm?
I didn't pronounce that letter.
Oh, squiggly I. Now, it's not so much it's a script I, but it's not a question for me of pronouncing the wretched things. There's no way that you could ever, by looking at what I've written, detect the difference between my script I's and my script J's. But so I avoid the problem by never using both in the same page. And that's what a matroid is. And if you sort of, then you can develop the elementary properties of such structures, and I'm not going to talk about that, right? If you want to talk about that, then I'm going to try to be much more broad, but, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that you can, once you've got independent sets, of course, you've got bases, and a basis is just a maximal independent set. This would all just be like elementary linear algebra, right? And once you've got independent sets, you can look at a subset of E and say, what's its rank? And the rank is the size of the maximal independent set in that subset. So all of these are just things. A circuit in a matroid, this is a concept that doesn't seem to naturally, it's something I can tell you. A circuit is a minimal set, minimal dependent set. In other words, it's a set that's not independent. All proper subsets are independent. That's not something that you'd see in linear algebra. That's something that sounds like more graph theoretical, and we'll come back to that later. A flat, well, a flat's an analogue of a subspace, right? So it's a set that's maximal with the property that, a set that's got the property that if I add any other elements, I'll increase its rank. Right? So it's an analogue of, or a closed set. And then we've got a closure operator. All of these things are just natural things that you can do. Actually, all of these things you can do, you can play this little game with not just matroids, all sorts of other types of structures. I shouldn't have said that because that's a distraction. If I take a set, I can add all of the possible elements I can add without increasing its rank, right? That's the closure of the set. So that's all of these things are quite natural. And of course, if you think about if this is induced from some set of vectors in a vector space, closure is just the span, isn't it? You know, but you've got this privileged set. You haven't got the whole vector space. I should stress that the closure is just a span, so you just pick up things that are in the span of that. And so that's all of those things are straightforward. And it's something that you can do with matroids is that instead of axiomatizing matroids by their independent sets, you can use any one of these other things to get alternative axiom schemes of matroids. And that's not deep and it's not difficult, it's time-consuming and frustrating. Because if you teach a course in matroid theory, you sort of have to go through this. And the really frustrating thing is that in the process of sort of getting bogged down with axiomatics and technicalities, you lose the wood for the trees. So I'm not going to get bogged down with axiomatics and technicalities. They're all phew. And so we've done all of that. So that's all good. All right, so the canonical, there's an excellent exposition of that sort of stuff in the book of James Oxley's. So the canonical situation in which we get a matroid is from a finite set of vectors in a vector space. And a sort of a standard way of doing this is as follows. I'll just hide that junk down there. So this vector space, by the way, is a vector space could be over the reals, but it could be over any field that we like. And the fields that are typically of most interest to us from the point of view of doing matroids are finite fields. And I used to wonder, matroids that arise from sets of vectors over finite fields are much better studied than matroids that arise from vectors over the reals, for example. And I've often wondered why that's true. And I think that the answer is that we'll perhaps start to see why that's true. First of all, some problems are doable for matroids over small finite fields that are not doable over arbitrary fields. And also, small finite fields, or finite fields in general, are more combinatorial. So if perhaps a more natural setting. Anyhow, there's a way I can get a matroid, and the set is A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and they're labelling those vectors, and I've piled up the vectors as into a matrix. And that's where the term matroid comes from. It's an aside, but at one stage in the history of matroid theory, there was a very bitter debate between representatives, I forget exactly how it was put, of some hidebound pockets of the British Commonwealth that continued to use the term matroid, and advanced areas of northeastern United States, namely Boston, which preferred to use the term combinatorial geometry. And they were right. Combinatorial geometry was a much better term than matroid. The term matroid arises because it's matrix-like, right? Whitney saw one way of getting a matroid was from the columns, column vectors of a matrix, and so that's where the term matroid came from. But once terminology's established, that's it. And I think the reason why matroid theory won was because Dominic Welch called his book Matroid Theory. Anyhow, so that's a standard way of getting a matroid. And so a matroid that you can get in that way, I'll call a representable matroid. So that matroid that I get from those columns, that's an example of a representable matroid. But of course, I haven't told you the field, so I better tell you the field now. And if that field is the two-element field, then the matroid I'll get will be different from if the field is the three-element field, right? And that's of course, typically going to be the case. And the reason is, if you look at DE and F, that's, if I add up, DEF is a linearly dependent set of columns over GF2, because 1 plus 1 is 0. It's a linearly independent set of columns over the three-element field. So I've got to tell you the field, right? So I've been ambiguous there, at least two possible matroids that I could get from that matrix. Once I tell you the field, the matroid is fixed. But that's a straightforward thing. So a representable matroid is a matroid that I can get from a field in that way. Okay, so that's straightforward. Just some terminology. A matroid is binary if I can get it from the two-element field. It's ternary if I can get it from the three-element field. That's just straightforward terminology. I'll come back to that later. I don't think I'm a born mathematician, because I can't understand stuff unless I can actually see it in a really elementary way. And so I look at a matrix and it just looks like gobbledygook for me. I've got to have a picture of something. And that's really one of the reasons why graph theory is such an attractive subject, because you can draw graphs, right? And you can look at them. And the thing about that is, you can draw matroids, well, at least some, I mean, a matroid can have very high rank, right? But that's a matroid with rank 3, the size of a maximal independent set in that matroid has 3 elements. Size of a basis in that matroid has rank 3. But if the matroid has low rank, then that's something we can draw. And of course, we know we can draw it because what we've got, if it's representable, it's a set of vectors in a vector space. And we can just plot those points. And when we plot those points, there's a picture of your matroid. It's not rocket science, but there are two ways that we can plot points, right? We can either use linear algebra way of plotting points, where we have this special point called the origin and stuff like that, which is not, I don't like that at all, and matroid theorists never use that, or essentially never use that. Or else we can use homogeneous coordinates, and that gains us actually that which is the projective geometry way of coordinatizing things. And that's much smoother because actually I've always thought, I tell my students this, I don't know how many, when I teach linear algebra, I tell my students there's an intrinsic weakness of linear algebra because linear algebra selects a special point called the origin. And there is no special point called the origin, right? That's a sort of a Copernican view of the universe, not a. So I much prefer the projective geometry, homogeneous coordinates, where there is no special point called the origin. All points are equal in status. And so that's the type of coordinatization we use. So if I were to plot those points in that way, then I can get diagrams, and there are two matroids there for the two-element and the three-element field. And the top one is the picture that I would get if I were to plot those points over the three-element field. So ADB, how do we see dependency there? Three points on a line are dependent, right? Three non-collinear points are independent. Two points determine the line, and then the third point is sort of depends on the other two. Three non-collinear points are independent. And so, for example, ACB, ABC is independent, ABCG is dependent, AD is independent, ADB is dependent, and so on. That's a nice sort of way of giving pictures for matroids of small rank, right? I mean, I did that by just sort of doing a diagram from the coordinates, but it's also a nice little code for drawing pictures of matroids of small rank. And it's obviously important that we have ways of doing that because the description of a matroid, the formal description of a matroid, is by a list of its independent sets. Well, I can improve that. I can make a more economical description of a matroid by going to bases, for example. Right, because once I know the bases, I can just take all subsets. But going to bases, there are still typically exponentially many bases in the size of the ground set. So it's an intrinsically, that's a tricky thing about matroids, that a matroid with a ground set of size n, typically you cannot describe that matroid. You can't even input that matroid without at least exponential number of things. So it's important that we have ways of looking at matroids that we don't have to, you know, without having to do a list of independent sets.
So that also means that computational complexity issues with matroids are a little bit subtle. You have to talk about how does the program get the matroid.
Yeah. And in fact, there's two types of computational complexity for matroid. One is where you take the size of the input to be the size of the ground set. And surprising one is that you can take the size of the input to be the size of the number of bases, for example. And it leads to different. Yeah.
But if you, for example, if you take the complexity to be the size of the ground set, but then you would give the program an oracle for
absolutely
testing independence.
You typically use oracle. Yeah. Exactly. And so that's most matroid complexity problems have used oracle complexity as a model. Yeah. All right. So now the second matroid that I've got here that's the example where if we took that over the two element field, and this squiggly line here represents that set that I showed you that was dependent in one but independent in the other. Those two matroids are sort of important, but they're for various reasons, but they're illustrative of a fact. This second matroid here, so if I look at a matroid, if I just give you a matroid, here's a question that I can ask, of course, is that matroid representable over a given field? Could I get that matroid from a set of vectors over that field? No? Just like, look at a graph, is that graph planar? Well, so it turns out that this matroid here is representable over the field if and only if the characteristic of the field is 2. So, and this matroid here is representable over a field if and only if the characteristic of the field is not 2. And so that's just a nice little example of the sorts of possibilities that arise. Well, Whitney asked the question, he realised, you can ask, well, what's the possibilities with matroids? We've axiomatized, we started off with sets of vectors in a vector space, and we've picked up these structures. What else have we picked up? And that's just the sort of thing that mathematicians love, because, you know, it's great for generating papers or whatever. But it's a genuinely, I mean, these things can be genuinely deep questions. And so the answer is you pick up a lot. You pick up an extraordinary amount. And the ones that you pick up, if you're not representable over any field, then I'll just say the matroid's not representable. So a representable matroid is a matroid that's representable over some field, right? And then you can be more specific. So here are examples of non-representable matroids. The first one is one that was known about for some time. We know that the non-Pappus matroid, that's a non-Pappus matroid, where you take the Pappus configuration and declare ABC to be non-collinear. We know that the non-Pappus matroid is a matroid because it lives inside a non-Pappian projective plane, and if there ever is such a thing as any projective plane, is certainly a matroid. But it's easy to see that. So that's a well-defined matroid, and so I draw the picture and then you can generate the independent sets from the picture, and that's perfectly well-defined. So that's an example of a non-representable matroid. Here's a minimal sized example. I just take, there's really a family of matroids that are very similar and are first discovered by Peter Barmusch. And where you just take, say, this is now in rank 4 or 3 dimensions, and so I just take a cube, say, and I have the natural dependencies. So these 4 points here are coplanar, so they're dependent, and so where you see coplanarities, you're seeing dependencies. And I have all of the dependencies that I would expect from a cube, except that I say, no, you don't have A, B, C, D. This is an independent set. And it turns out, and it's actually a little theorem in projective geometry. By the way, I sort of sometimes say that matroid theory is really modern projective geometry. I feel that that's but I don't know whether I'm telling lies when I say that, but I feel it is to me. Anyhow, that turns out to be, that's a matroid. It's not representable over any field, and it's a minimal-sized example. And you can ask the question then, well, we picked up this stuff. Have we just picked up a little bit of stuff, or have we picked up a lot of stuff? And, of course, if you're a mathematician and you've been around for a while, you know what the answer is. In advance, you'll know what the answer is going to be. For sure, you've picked up a lot of stuff, and you've discovered an irrational number, right? Okay, well, there can't be too many of those. Well, in fact. And of course, the answer is that the proportion of representable matroids is asymptotically zero as the number of the size of the ground set goes towards infinity. And
is it exponentially small?
I'm sure it's exponentially small. I don't know if we know that it's
probably. Exponentially.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. That's right. And the number of the matroids really, so you've really let the cat out of the bag when you just look at matroids axiomatically and you say, we toss in the non-representable ones. It's very easy to be a matroid, turns out it's very easy to be a matroid, so I always forget this, but Gordon's been doing work recently on enumerating matroids. And up until a year or two ago, it was really only known how many matroids there were on ground sets of up to size 7 or 8, Gordon, right? But can you tell us what the numbers are for ground sets of size 9, 10, and 11? And I can have a little break while you're doing that.
For 8 elements, it's about 1,300 non-isomorphic ones. 9 elements is about 400,000. And then 10 elements is at least 3 times 10 to the 12.
Yeah.
But you know that it's growing at least e to the n.
think we have very good lower bounds.
You're capping up to isomorphism.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So they really grow extraordinarily quickly anyhow.
You said there is a theorem that representability is asymptotically rare.
Yeah. I mean, but it's not my area, and I'm sure that these theories are true, but I'm not, so.
Let me ask one more question, since the original goal was to axiomatize independence in a vector space. Could we have missed an axiom?
You're actually asked exactly the question that Whitney asked in an original paper in a slightly different form. He said the fundamental question of adding the extra axiom, and there is a paper, I forget who wrote the paper, it might have been Peter Barmosh, right? And it's called the missing axiom of matroid theory is lost forever. It's one of these things that you need to be a logician or something, but it's just not going to be the case. But I'll come back, I'll talk about those sorts of questions in a little while, but these are very interesting. Very interesting things. You're a dangerous person now, and you ask such interesting questions that it makes it increasingly difficult to get through the material. So now I'm just going to develop a little bit of basic facts about matroids. So, as with any structure, we can look for the notion of substructure, right? That's the way we gain. And so with matroids, we just think of the way we can remove an element. Well, deletion is perfectly natural, right? If I give you a matroid and just throw an element away, and then what I've got left is still a well-defined matroid, so there's a picture of a matroid, throw the element away, and that's M delete E. And that's like, if I give you a finite set of vectors in a vector space, just throw one away, and that's deletion. So that sort of seems, this is an interesting thing, that seems like a trivial operation. The next operation doesn't seem so trivial. I can contract the element. Well, contraction, you all know about in other contexts, but I don't really want to talk about that at the moment. But now what am I saying? If I contract the element, I'm saying the independent sets of the contraction are the subsets, well, we don't have E anymore, the subsets of E minus E that will remain independent if I add E. So they're the independent subsets that contain E with E removed. And it's a straightforward, easy exercise to prove that that gives you a well-defined matroid, and that's contraction. Well, so what? Who cares? Well, what does contraction mean? If it's of any use, we've got to look at what that means in the model we have. And so far, we only have one model. So it sets of vectors in a vector space. And this was one of the things that I saw, and this is one of the things that convinced me that matroid theory really is modern projective geometry, because contraction is just projection from an element. So if I take that picture of that matroid there, and I decide to contract E, well, that's a rank 3 matroid, so that's living in a projective plane. So imagine this is happening over the real, so it's living in the real projective plane. I just take any line, and it doesn't matter, just any line at all, and then I project the other points from E down onto that line. And of course what happens is that B will go down somewhere, A and F will end up at the same place, but we distinguish them. And that's okay because you can think of those as the two elements labelling the same column, so it's a multi-set type thing. And so I get, and these are called parallel elements, by the way, when you it's a two-element dependent set. And I get this matroid here. And that is a picture of the contraction. So contraction is projection from a point. Now what am I saying in general? What I'm saying, if I want to be more specific, is if I take a represented matroid, you know, sort of set of vectors in a vector space, and I've got an element and I want to get the matroid that corresponds to contracting from that element, I choose any hyperplane I like, and it doesn't matter which one I choose. I project from that element through the other elements onto the hyperplane. Of course, the configurations that I get from doing that will depend on the choice of hyperplane. But with that labelling, with the natural labelling, those configurations all give you isomorphic matroids, and those isomorphic matroids are the contraction. So contraction is projection, and projection is a totally natural way of getting substructure. Right? I mean, that's how we see the world. We're seeing a contraction of the world onto the back of our eyeballs. Right? It's a substructure of the world. And the challenge for us, and we have a bit of an advantage with binocular vision, the challenge for us is to reconstruct the world from that. I mean, it's, you know, we've been doing matroid theory all your life and you didn't know it. You know? And it's just a totally natural thing. And I want to really stress that it's a totally natural thing too, because for people who come from a background of graph theory, they tend to see the operations that you're doing in matroids as somehow weird generalizations of graph operations. That's not true. What you're doing is perfectly natural operations if you're thinking from a geometric perspective. All right, so I can do a sequence of contractions and deletions, and that, surprisingly enough, gives you a substructure called a minor. So again, this is just something that you would do if you thought about it. And these are the substructures. Anything I contain by an arbitrary sequence of deletions and contractions is a minor. And of course, then you can ask for a class of matroids. It's natural to have a minor closed class. All minors belong to the class. So for example, if I take the class of fix a field and look at the F representable matroids, all the matroids that are representable over that field, that is a minor closed class. I didn't prove it to you, but given the model I talked about how you did contraction, it's clear that it's not going to be rocket science to come up with a proof. So, and this is something that we can do. Once we have the notion of a minor closed class, we can ask questions of, we say, well, what's an excluded minor? And an excluded minor is a matroid that's minor minimal with respect to not being in the class. All right, so let's have a look at a little example to illustrate these ideas, because these ideas are just very important, right? So I've got deletion contraction, ways of removing elements, arbitrarily sequence of removals gives you the notion of a minor. Many natural classes of matroids have the property that they're minor closed. And then we can ask for a minor closed class what it means for a matroid to be an excluded minor. There's the four-point line, which has got a name, who cares, but it's called U24. The four-point line is not binary. I can't get a four-point line from the two-element field. You can try, and you just never can. But it turns out that all proper minors of that thing are binary, so that's an excluded minor for representability over GF2. Now, TART, this is so here's a theorem. Now, we have that, and this is not a difficult theorem to prove. It's just not something I can do in this lecture, but in this talk, but if it's the sort of thing that you can easily, it's the sort of thing you must do in any graduate course in matroid theory, or at least if you're doing structural matroid theory. A matroid is binary, so this goes back to the 1950s. A matroid is binary if and only if it doesn't have the four-point line as a minor. So it's not just that U24 is an excluded minor for representability over GF2. It is the only excluded minor. So in some sense, there's the missing axiom for representability over GF2. That's a good characterization of representability. Well, I don't want to get into the complexity aspects of what the complexity theoretic implications of this are. But what it does to say is, I can very quickly prove to you that a matroid is not binary by showing you a U24 minor. Right? It doesn't tell you how I can prove to you that a matroid is binary. The rest of this slide is actually nothing for you. It's for me so that I remember to say the things that I wanted to say. Right. So the next thing is Rota's conjecture, and so now that goes back to the 1950s. And so in the 1970s, it's just got a slightly complicated symbol. Seymour and some other people obtained a similar characterization of ternary matroids, the matroids that you can get from the three-element field. And there are some more excluded minors, not many, just a few, but I'm not going to say what they are. Actually, that question mark for GF4 should be a tick. And so that was 20 years later. At that time, Giancarlo Rota conjectured that that a similar result existed for every finite field. For each finite field, there was a characterization of the, for each finite field GFQ, there was a characterization of the class of GFQ representable matroids by a finite list of excluded minors. Right, so, and that was in the 1970s that Rota conjectured that. A few years ago, it was proved by Geelin, Gerards, and Kapoor for GF4. And the difficulty of the proofs rose very, very quickly. And it's still not known to be true for fields of size more than 4. For what it's worth, this is just really for if you're a matroid theorist and you're in structural matroid theory, Rota's conjecture is sort of thought of as being the central conjecture in matroid theory, and in some sense trying to prove that and working in that world, that's my life. There you go, I've shown you my life. And I can tell you, at times it's not pretty. I sometimes wish I sometimes regret it. But progress is being made. Progress is being made, but it's still not resolved for any field of size bigger than 4. But I do believe that I'm guessing that, say, within the next 10 or 15 years, there will exist a proof of Rota's conjecture in general. Yeah, I mean, or perhaps for prime fields, you know, but.
So Rota's conjecture is somehow analogous to the Robertson-Seymour theorem in graph theory?
What's analogous to the Robertson... Okay, so I'll tell you the... I'll perhaps talk a little bit more about this in the next talk if I get time, but the analogous conjecture to the Robertson-Seymour conjecture is that I give you the class of GFQ representable matroids. Then the class of GFQ representable matroids is well quasi-ordered with respect to the minor order. And that is, that's actually Jim and Bert and I are working on trying to, on that. We believe that will be solved sometime in the next.
And that's stronger than Rota?
No, it's weaker than Rota. It's independent of Rota's conjecture.
Oh, I see.
But whatever techniques are used to prove well quasi-ordering, we believe that those techniques can be extended to prove Rota's conjecture in general. But it's genuinely conceivably independent, and yeah. Because Rota's conjecture is a conjecture about matroids that are not GFQ representable, whereas the well quasi ordering conjecture is just a conjecture about matroids that are GFQ representable. That cross beside infinite fields means all of that stuff that we talked about there is no longer true. If you give any infinite field, it's easy to come up with an infinite list of excluded minors. And I think the fact that there are an infinite list of excluded minors is somehow equivalent, but I'm equivalent to saying for an infinite field, there's no extra axiom that you can add, or simple extra axiom that you could add to get the to characterize representability. And infinite fields are not well quasi ordered. It's easy to find infinite antichains of matroids that are representable over any given infinite field. So, in fact, you can find infinite antichains of matroids that representable over all infinite fields, you know. So it's so that really does tell you that somehow matroid theory becomes, well, we believe that there's something tractable about matroid theory when you're talking about representability over finite fields that's not true in the case for representability over infinite fields. All right, so that's a sort of a digression into the story of my current life. But now I want to go through and get some sort of more basic things about matroids. So let's return. Another thing about matroids is that there's a straightforward notion, it's easy to define, of duality for matroids. I'm fascinated by notions of duality. By the way, matroid duality, if you know about projective geometry, matroid duality is not projective geometry duality. It's a different sort of duality. But if I give you the set of bases of a matroid, and the matroid has the set of elements of the matroid is E, then I can just look at the complements of bases. Right? Just take the complements of bases, and that gives me another collection of sets, and that collection of sets turns out to be the collection of bases of a matroid, and it's a 10-line proof to do it. It's just a little bit of set theory, really. And the first thing is, so what? Who cares? The fact that I've got, if you give me one matroid and here's a way of constructing another matroid, and it's certainly a duality because if you do it twice, you get back to the original matroid. But is it interesting? Is it interesting? It's not by no means obvious that once you do something like this that it's interesting. And here's the first bit of evidence that it's interesting, is that if I delete an element and take the dual, that I get the same matroid as if I took the dual and contracted an element. Now that's genuinely sort of quite interesting because contraction seems somewhat, deletion seems like a trivial operation, duality is a trivial operation, you just complement, and yet contraction seems somewhat less trivial, yet, you know, there you go, you know, the you get the third from the first two. So that's it. So another thing is, okay, so what does duality correspond to for represented matroids? And I'll just do a quick diversion. Will I tell you about this or not? Yes, I'll. So if I give you a represented matroid, then what I've got is a matrix there. And the elements of the matroid are the columns, right? Now, I could actually take, if I just, and I can always assume that these rows are linearly independent, right? That they're just, if I've got linearly dependent rows, then I've got some redundancy in there because I could just eliminate one, it won't change. But conversely, I could actually take, extend this, say it's a finite field, I could take all linear combinations of these rows and look at this big matrix here. And I won't have changed the matroid, right? It's just easy to see that the set is independent if I take a linear combination of these rows and add that. No. So I can actually extend that to a subspace. And there's a curious thing that you can think of a represented matroid as a subspace in a way. You take a subspace, list it like that, and think of the matroid on the columns. And that subspace has an orthogonal subspace. And if I take the orthogonal subspace and I take and do the orthogonal subspace and it's on the same set of elements, then the same deal, the matroid reversing the thing, then I get a matroid and that matroid is the dual matroid. And for those of you who know about coding theory, this is an entirely familiar thing to do. You take the generator matrix of a code and this thing over here is the parity check matrix of the code. So matrix duality corresponds to duality of subspaces in orthogonality of subspaces in a vector space, and it corresponds to coding theory duality in the sense of. So that tells you that that's evidence that matroid duality is interesting because it corresponds to things that we know are interesting in other contexts. But I'll come back to matroid duality. All right, so now I haven't mentioned graphs at all, and now we delve into the world of graphs. And, of course, what motivated Whitney to develop the theory of matroids in the first place was that he was trying to prove the four-colour conjecture. Yeah.
Can you explain in this duality language, this duality, this formula over there, M of G minus E is...
Yeah, I could, but... I won't. No, and I'm not even sure I can do it off the top of my head, even though I do it when I teach courses in matroid theory. It's just that you have to go through and do the algebra. But it is, but if you want to talk about it afterwards, yeah. All right, so Whitney was actually trying to prove the four-colour conjecture. And he was really noticing that a lot of theorems in graph theory reminded me of theorems in linear algebra. And that was what, and so he thought, well, perhaps if I can, you know, if I find an algebraic setting for this stuff, it all goes smoothly. History tells us otherwise it didn't all go smoothly, which is a great tragedy, but such is life. Okay, so if I start with a graph, I can associate a matroid with a graph. In fact, there are lots of ways that you can associate matroids with graphs, but from our point of view, this is the important one. And I choose the edges of the graph. So the vertices disappear, right? So now this is, if you're not used to this, you've got to think, I've got a graph. Okay, there's a matroid I can associate with the graph, but the fundamental things in the graph are the edges, not the vertices. The edges are the things that the graph, the vertices are just telling you which edges are incident.
Is this
or
why
adjacent.
You called the ground set in the general matroid E? You concealed it from us. The reason?
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, it just depends what mood I'm in, because if I'm starting to talk now, I can say yes, but before I could easily say no. It's E for elements, the elements of a matrix. So I'm in a win-win situation, yeah. Yeah, so it's interesting that we typically do use E for a ground set of a matroid. But I'm also a little bit wary of doing matroid theory in a way that leads people with the expectation that all matroids are graphic, because that's just so not true. But anyhow, I think that's historically the reason. So what are the independent sets in this matroid? They're the edge sets of forest in the graph. Good little exercise if you want to do a bit of matroid theory. Prove that the edge sets of forests in the graph are the independent sets of a matroid. And if you've done that, you'll be able to prove, you'll have a very quick proof that Kruskal's algorithm worked for finding a minimum cost spanning tree, because that's a triviality that an algorithm like, greedy algorithms like that work for matroids, but that's a distraction. And again, what we want to know is this a good matroid for the graph? And what do I mean by a good matroid for the graph? Oh, there's lots of other matroids I could associate with the graph, right? I could just take any matrix. Lots of matrices that you can associate with a graph. Any matrix is a, you know, I could take the incidence matrix or whatever. And so, and that would give this various ways, but why is one more interesting than another? And the thing is that the matroid structure, when I do this, the matroid structure reflects the graph structure. What do I mean by that? I mean that deletion corresponds, right? So if I delete an edge in the graph and then take the matroid, that's the same as taking the matroid and then deleting. And if I contract, contraction corresponds. And that's genuinely interesting, right? So we have this natural operation in graphs and of contracting an edge. And that corresponds, if we think geometrically, if we're thinking matroidally, to projection. So it's interesting that contraction, but way more interesting, well, what's really... This still surprises me. This fact still surprises me. That duality corresponds. So planar duality in planar graphs is the same as duality in matroids. And it's all of a sudden starting to tell you that, okay, matroids might be an interesting tool, because if I've got a non-planar graph, I can take the matroid and then I can take the dual of the matroid. And that's perfectly well-defined combinatorial object. And maybe that starts to explain why you have natural sort of, even for non-planar graphs, you still somehow see dualities and comes via matroids. All right, so that, and why do I think this is surprising? Because duality, graph, planar graph duality is a topological concept. I mean, matroid duality via the vector space is an algebraic sort of concept, and that's okay. And there's no a priori reason, apart from seeing that it works, there's no a priori reason to think that planar graph duality should correspond to matroid duality. I mean, you know, maybe I lived in a world where habitually we drew our graphs on a torus rather than the plane. And then the natural notion of duality for graphs would be duality on the torus. And that doesn't correspond to matroid duality. It's planar duality that corresponds to matroid duality. And that's somehow, I don't know, still mysterious to me, because I just can't see why that has to be true. But I think that's somehow the amazing thing in mathematics, that strands that you would expect to be separate turn out not to be separate. They're connected. All right, so here's a bit of revision for you. There's a graph G. No, it's not just revision, sorry. This slide contains variety of things that I want to say. There's a graph G. We can ask the question about the matroid of the graph. What's this matroid like? What sort of matroid? Is it representable? Right? That seems like the only thing we've known about matroids is some are representable, some are not. And if it is representable, over which fields is it representable? Right? So that's the questions that you can ask. And I meant to change these, but what you do is, so here's, and again, this is all straightforward, easy exercise. Take the graph, this is the incidence matrix, I always forget which is which. Take this matrix associated with the graph, and then just do columns, but make the second one a minus one. So that minus 1 is correct. All of these 1s here should be minus 1s, right? Then it's a straightforward exercise to say that over any field that you like, and it doesn't matter whether the field has characteristic 2 or not, if the field has characteristic 2, minus 1 is equal to 1 and all is fine, over any field that you like, that matrix represents the matroid of that graph. So there, and that, so in some sense, which matroid, so and conversely, if I give you a matrix, if somehow I can, and it has that form, where there are at most 2 elements in each row, each column, sorry, 2 non-zero entries in each column, then that's the matroid of some graph. And now we've got one of the things that I think is, it's just an elementary thing, but it confuses people because we've got 2 ways of visualizing matroids, right? If the matroid is graphic, the graph is a way of visualizing the matroid. Otherwise, what way have we got of visualizing a matroid? We can look at the projective drawing, the little drawing. And so now it's very, very easy to get confused, because in one, the elements of the matroid are the edges, and the edges can look remarkably like lines. In another, the elements of the matroid are these points. And so you should convince yourself that second picture is actually a geometric representation of the matroid of G. It's a geometric representation of the matroid of G. And it's, again, takes some time to do it, but, you know, like CFD, that's independent in the matroid. Is it independent in the graph? Is it the edge set of a forest in a graph? Amazingly enough, it is. ABC is not independent in the matroid. All subsets are independent in the matroid. That's a circuit in the matroid. And if you look up, AFC is a... Yeah.
We have 2 B's here. 1 should be E.
Oh, right. So that's the... I've always thought that it'd be good to have deliberate errors in my... So that's an extra... The bottom one should be E, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, sorry about that, yeah. So anyhow, so one of the things is that you've got to learn to be a little bit bilingual, it's important to understand matroids. It's important to be able to look at a graph and see what's going on matroidally, and it's important to be able to see a geometric representation and see what's going on matroidally, and it's important not to be confused between the two.
Why did you put the minus 1
under A? Because otherwise it doesn't work. It's just you should have minus 1s everywhere. You should have minus 1s everywhere. The second entry should be a minus 1 all through there.
So this matrix should be the directed vertex edge incidence matrix for some orientation.
For some orientation, but that's right. But you see, in some sense, it's arbitrary, because I can sort of always take any scale of... I can always switch it. It's just I just did some convention to get that.
What's the field?
Any field. Yeah, so if I didn't... that's an arbitrary field, right? So if it's a field of characteristic 2, minus 1 is equal to 1, and that's fine. And so what we've proved, by the way, there is what we haven't proved, but what one can prove is, once you know that it didn't matter which field I choose, that still works. What one can prove is that we now know that the class of graphic matroids that we can get from graphs in that way, is a class of matroids represented over every field. So somehow there really are. It also tells us that the class of graphic matroids is a very small subclass of the class of matroids altogether. It's a very small subclass of the class of representable matroids. There's not much. There's a very small class there. I'll just say a couple more things, and it doesn't surprise me. I sort of expect... This is... My expectation happened because I saw what was happening to other speakers, that I didn't get through as much material as I'd hoped to. But one thing is, the matroid is an invariant of the graph. It doesn't tell you what the graph is, right? If the graph I give you is a forest with n edges, I give you 2 forests with n edges on the same set, the matroids are identical. What is the matroid? It contains one basis. The whole whole thing. Every set is independent. So actually, you might think, well, that's not very useful. If you're interested in studying enumerating trees, for example, you better not do it matroidally. So the matroid doesn't distinguish forests, for example. But as the connectivity of the graph increases, the matroid tells you more about the graph. And if the graph is three connected, then the matroid, from the matroid, you can reconstruct the graph up to essentially. And I guess the only thing, when I say essentially, I guess the only thing that you is that you don't know whether the graph has isolated vertices or not, but because vertices have gone, you know. But so you know, like on the one hand, that's sort of quite surprising, because this is, once you see that the matroid doesn't distinguish forests of any type, you think, well, you know, but you just have to have a bit of connectivity, not too much, and then you're away. What I'll do is I'll I won't go too long, but talking about connectivity, if you really want to understand matroid theory, and from the, well, connectivity is the thing that you need to think about. I don't know whether that's true or not. I'm just proselytizing there, but I'm doing it anyhow, because it's somehow the field. The more time I think about connectivity, the more I learn. So what I want to do is just tell you now, and I'll revise it at the start of the next talk, is what does connectivity mean matroidally? And so forget about graph connectivity. Just one of the things you want to do if you want to understand matroids is just forget about graphs and say, what would I do if I didn't know what a graph was and I wanted to have some notion of connectivity? Well, here's the connectivity function of a matroid. It's a function and it's defined for all partitions of the ground set. And what's its value on a partition? It's the rank of A plus the rank of B minus the rank of M. Now, what would that mean? What does that mean geometrically? So I just take, so think about that. I've got, so okay, here we are in a vector space, very high rank a million or whatever. And I've got a set, here's my set A, and here's my set B. Well, the rank of A plus the rank of B minus the rank of M is, what it's saying is that if I take the span of A, that's a subspace, take the span of B, that's another subspace. So the rank of that subspace, what's the rank of M? It's the rank of the union of those subspaces. So what's this thing calculating? Well, the rank of the span of A plus the rank of the span of B minus the rank of the span of the A union B minus the rank of the span of A intersect the span of B is equal to zero. That's something that you teach in an elementary course in linear algebra. So that's measuring the rank, if I take A and take B, that's measuring the rank of the subspace that I get, that's the intersection of the span of A with the span of B. Now, what should connectivity be measuring? Connectivity should be measuring communication. How much communication is there? How connected are you? How much communication is going on, you know? They're all standing in the room, but they're not talking, you know, there are no edges. No connectivity, no communication. So if I take two sets of vectors in a vector space and I say, how much communication is there between those two sets? Well, what can this set of vectors communicate with by itself? It can communicate with anything that's in its span. That's what linear, that's what sort of, the span of a set of vectors is all the vectors that you can reach from that set of vectors. So if I look at the span of that set of vectors intersected with the span of this set of vectors, it gives me the set of vectors that I can reach from here and reach from there. And that set of vectors that I can reach from both sides, the rank of that set of vectors, is a measure of how much communication I can get between those two things. And that's just purely a totally natural way to think of connectivity of two sets, two subsets in a vector space. So, for example, if they were skew, there is no communication, right? There's no connectivity.
But you have to imagine doing this in the whole vector space and not just in E.
Yep. So I'm all to, I mean, okay, so that's a good.
So in other words, this is not equal to the rank of closure A intersect.
No, because closure of A intersect closure of B could be empty. So, for example, so in the sort of model I have, is, so think about A and B. So I'll just say it again, because I probably didn't explain that very well. Here's my big vector space. So it's a full vector space, but my matroid now I'm thinking of a subset of vectors in the vector space. And I'm saying, so really I'm trying to explain what this lambda would measure if the vectors were in a vector space. But these are the vectors that I are in my matroid, they're the ones of interest. And I say, to what extent can these vectors here communicate with these vectors here? Well, of course, what do I mean by communicate? So that's the question. Well, now, if I look at the rank, so the thing is that the span of A intersect the span of B, there may well be, in those intersections, there may well be no elements of A or B, or there may well be a lot. So, in fact, in the matroid, the rank of A intersect B may well be zero. But in the vector space, the rank of the span of A intersect the rank of the span of B is a full subspace. And this thing here is measuring the size of that subspace. And what I'm claiming is the size of that subspace is exactly the natural measure to tell you to what extent A and B can communicate with each other in some way. I mean, it's a sort of a ideological thing, but I think the ideology, we will see that the ideology is supported by evidence in the next talk. Thanks a lot.
I got an observation about this thing, about the duality. I mean, like the matrix of the dual graph is equal to the dual matrix of the graph at all. That was like natural in the plane, but you wouldn't find it that. I mean, you don't find why it is natural on the plane. And so my impression is that it is natural that outside the plane it doesn't happen like that, because if you got a bunch of loops, the matroid does not realize how they are interlaced, while the topology does realize how they are interlaced. In my meaning, with a bunch of loops, the matroid just takes them away, and the topology looks at how they are, like who is coming first and who is coming
later. I see. So,
yes. So if you have a graph embedded in a surface, you can more or less play to be in the plane doing the dilation and contraction and so on until you are left with a bunch of loops non-homotopical to zero.
Yeah. And that just shows you how much more you know about that than I do. But that, I understand what. And I did mean to mention that the questions of how other types of graph duality, for example, on the torus or the projective plane, relate to matroid duality is an extremely interesting one. And Tom knows a lot more about that than I do. So. Yeah.
Typically, if you take a non-planar graph and you look at the matroid of the graph, is it a graphic matroid?
No. It's only graphic. It's graphic if and only if I take. So if I take a non-planar graph and I take the matroid dual, the question was, could that be graphic? And the answer is no. And the way to prove that is to look at the matroid dual of K33, and the dual of the matroid of K33, and show that that's not graphic, and the dual of the matroid of K5, and show that that's not graphic, and then that's just a straightforward exercise. So the dual of a matroid is graphic if and only if the graph is planar. Yeah. Tom.
Maybe we could use this opportunity to propagandize for the oriented incidence matrix of the graph as being the better incidence matrix. We have a lot of graph theorists here. The unoriented incidence matrix with all ones doesn't work except occasionally. The right matrix is the one with plus ones and minus ones. Of course, it depends on your purposes, but here's an important purpose where that's true.
You saw that also in Bill Jackson's talk where he defined flows. It's important to
it's
know
related.
whether
it's
the stuff is
related.
Coming into a vertex or out of a vertex.
Yeah. It's the same thing.
I might add, too, that when I talked about the matrix tree theorem, I had the signed incidence matrix there, and the key lemma that I mentioned is exactly the proof that the matroid doesn't depend on the characteristic of the field.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's exactly right. It's just a very nice factor.
I might also mention that in the use of that signed incidence matrix for these purposes in matroid theory, it doesn't matter which of the plus minus one entries is plus and which is minus.
No.
And that making that distinction is is equivalent to what has been mentioned in some of the talks, is choosing an arbitrary orientation for each edge.
Mm. You see, you can choose an arbitrary orientation for each edge, or else I can make the observation that if I take a representation of a matroid and multiply any column by a scalar, I'm not changing the matroid. So all I have to do is say, I could an arbitrary orientation, or else I could just say arbitrarily assign one a plus one or a minus one. Because there is an arbitrariness, even if I call the second one the minus one, because the arbitrariness was the ordering of the vertices in the rows. So all of these things are sort of in some sense equivalent there.
So here's a question for the physicist. Is this what it means to be a pseudo-scalar? That the sign is an arbitrary convention?
No. It has to do with, you consider representations of O-N and consider representations of S-O-N. So a pseudo-scalar is something that transforms as a scalar under S-O-N, but flips sign under reflection.
Okay, so it is something.
Similarly, just the vector and pseudo-vector.
Is there something which kind of behaves like a determinant in this thing?
I think the answer is no.
Maybe the answer is maybe.
Well, I think the answer is yes.
Ah, well. I feel it's pretty wide open, actually. I suggest that as a research problem.
to support the yes answer, if you distinguish one basis in the matroid, and then sort of relabel the bases, let's say, in terms of the complement of the intersection, the complement in this distinguished basis of the intersection with the distinguished basis, union with the intersection of the basis with the complement of the distinguished set, you get a pair of sets, one in the distinguished basis and the other outside, the other set inside the complement of the distinguished basis. These two sets have equal size, and they behave like the minors. Whether these sets correspond to a zero or non-zero minor is the analog of determinants.
Mm.
In other words, and specifically in a representable matroid, if you do row operations to transform the column.
Actually, there is another thing too. Yeah. Is that one way you can axiomatize matroids is you choose something that's going to be a fixed basis. In fact, you don't you don't even have to do that. But you choose something that has to be a fixed basis. And then what you do is you put your basis elements down there, and you put the rest of the elements, I'm probably saying what you said.
Yeah.
And then you have this array,
yeah.
Right? And actually you then have to decide, for example, you can decide whether something's zero or each entry is zero or non-zero. The whole point is that you've got these square submatrices, right? And to decide whether it's what the matroid is, to know the matroid, it suffices to know, if it were represented, it would suffice to know that the determinant was zero or non-zero.
Yeah.
So what you've got is a bunch of zeros or non-zeros that you can associate with all of the square submatrices of this array. And I'm sure I'm saying exactly what you're saying. And then you ask, It's another way of axiomatizing matroids. You can say, well, actually, those zero non-zero patterns, you only know it up to zero or non-zero. You don't know anything more than that. That will give you a matroid so long as certain natural properties hold, and they will be the properties that you would expect from determinants, you know, with interacting.
But yeah. this works even for non-representable matroids.
Sure, and I think there's a sort of a history that there's, if you look up on, it's more explicitly done in oriented matroids for some reason. If you see the oriented matroid book.
The science of it.
The history
of it is Lex Shriver published a monograph and called the blinking systems. And then kind of independently, Joe Kung called them bimatroids.
That's right. So the answer to your question is yes, in some sense. Yeah, you had a question.
And you can recover, if you have this list of vanishing and unvanishing.
You can recover the matroid from that list.
But probably this list of minors is sort of excessive.
But any way of describing a matroid is excessive. So, because what that would do would give you a formal way. I mean, you're representing it as a square array, but you're getting a formal way of describing an exponential list of things. You see, in fact, even when I represent a matroid over a field, what I've got is actually, I've got a polynomial description in the sense that I've just got a polynomial number of entries. But the matroid, there's still an exponential number of things that I've got to decide whether they're independent or not, which is saying that there's an exponential number of subdeterminants that I have to know whether a zero or non-zero. It's just for a represented matroid, I've got this nice polynomial way of actually getting that. For an arbitrary matroid, I've just got to tell you which of those square subarrays corresponds to a zero or a non-zero. So it is excessive, but everything's excessive for non-representable matroids, tragically.
In line with matroid axiomatizations derived from ideas about determinants, if you consider the Grassmann-Pluhar identity.
That's the relationship.
And think about it combinatorially. The result will be an axiom for matroids.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
And you axioms for matroids or for some subclass of
matroids.
Yeah. So you just take those Grassmann-Pluhar identities. I haven't thought about these for a long time, and then you can use those to axiomatize matroids.
You get a strong form of a basis exchange axiom, which is logically equivalent to the weak forms and everything else. Mm.
It's related to that. There was a conjecture by Rota about a square matrix where you have vectors as entries. Vectors in Rn and matrices n by n. You suppose that the rows are bases. Question: can you permute each row individually so that the columns become bases?
Yeah, that's.
And I was wondering if you can state that purely in terms of matroid, and if in the matroid.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's a purely matroidal conjecture. I think Rota stated it matroidally. I think there is a. It's a sort of a symmetric. You can state it as a symmetric basis exchange thing. Yeah. And it is, I believe, an extremely difficult conjecture. It's not one I've ever looked at, you know. But I know people who've looked at it and sort of have spoken to me in shell shock. Perhaps I better coffee time. I think.
Yeah.